Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
From KQED in San Francisco and Public Radio International, it's Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. On this week's show, how a murder 25 years ago shapes Asian American identity today. Filipino veterans may be a few steps closer in getting recognition for their service in World War II. And Vietnamese leaders woo American investors. But it's not business as usual.
If you don't help the country develop now, the only people that get hurt is poor people in Vietnam. And it's not really helping the communist government, it's helping the people.
Pacific Time, your passport to Asia, America, and our Asian American communities. Welcome to Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha.
Freedom!
Bo-bin-am.
Democracy!
Bo-bin-am.
Women dip!
Bo-ho-ho.
Women dip!
Bo-ho-ho.
That may not sound so welcoming, but don't take it personally. It was directed at Vietnam's president, Nguyen Minh Triết. He made his first visit to the U.S. last week and was met by protesters in each of the cities he stopped in. Anti-communist sentiments still run high among many of the 1.5 million Vietnamese Americans here, and nowhere higher than in Orange County, California, home to the largest population of Vietnamese outside of Asia. Several thousand people showed up for a rally across the street from the posh hotel overlooking the Pacific Ocean where the delegation stayed.
Would you forgive somebody who goes to your house, killing your family member, taking your home away, kick you away from your house? Would you forgive that people? Would you forgive somebody who just jailed your dad for 12, 15 years for fighting because what he believed in? Would you forgive somebody who basically making your people suffer? The people who ask forgiveness are the people who are just, they have not suffered under those communism.
At 29, Zui Nguyen is one of the younger protesters. Most are in their 50s and 60s and even older. They're refugees who fled Vietnam after the war ended in 1975 and the communist regime took over. Some lost everything they owned, while others were jailed for many years before they were able to leave for America. In the past, visits by top communist leaders have been private and quiet, partly to avoid scenes like this. When Vietnam's prime minister visited last year, he avoided Orange County altogether. But on this first trip by a Vietnamese president since the end of the war, Nguyen and his delegation seemed to be making a stand. They took out a full-page ad in the Washington Post to make their case to the American people. And Nguyen's message in Orange County was in part intended for the Vietnamese Americans who oppose him and the Communist Party. The message? Capitalism is on the march in Vietnam.
In total, the agreement and contracts we have signed have a value of over $11 billion U.S. dollars. Vietnam today is a new country. It's an open Vietnam, and one that's integrated into the world economy. We're looking toward the future. It's an economy that's dynamic and on the rise.
The Vietnamese president took every opportunity to pitch the Southeast Asian country's investment potential. While more than 1,000 protesters converged outside his hotel for a second day of demonstrations, he addressed a breakfast meeting.
And the government of Vietnam is doing everything possible to create a very friendly environment for businesses.
The delegation signed agreements with Microsoft and other American firms, and President Nguyen shook hands with President Bush on another preliminary trade agreement. Relations between the United States and its former enemy have flourished since President Clinton ended the trade embargo on Vietnam 13 years ago. Now the United States is the largest market for Vietnamese goods, and bilateral trade soared to more than $9 billion last year. And American businesses are chasing profits in Vietnam. They've invested $2.3 billion this year. At a dinner reception in Orange County, the number of Vietnamese Americans applauding President Nguyen inside a ballroom rivaled the numbers chanting for human rights outside, though many of the business people didn't want to speak to reporters on the record before the dinner. Vietnamese American entrepreneurs are often criticized in the community for doing business with the homeland. But the president's dinner speech put the crowd at ease. All Vietnamese come from the same motherland, he told them. It's time to put differences aside.
I got goosebumps hearing what he had to say.
Pham Ngoc Chan is a doctor in Orange County who said he came out of curiosity.
He was very sincere. He talked about the humanity between people. He didn't talk about political ideology or the Communist Party. Tonight, I really felt there's nothing separating the two sides anymore.
Chris Do traveled more than 400 miles to attend the dinner.
I have uncles who were put in concentration camps. But for me, I think those days are done and over. I work at Merrill Lynch. My goal one day is to maybe help Vietnam get financial understanding. And, you know, there's no mortgages in Vietnam. That's something that could allow the regular Joe in Vietnam to actually own a home.
These overseas Vietnamese, also known as Viet Q, have become the bridge between a changing Vietnam and their fellow expatriates who want nothing to do with the authoritarian government. Rather than turn their backs on their mother country, some choose to engage and hope that brings change.
We're all Vietnamese now, and the war was a long time ago. And if you don't help the country develop now, the only people that get hurt is the poor people in Vietnam. We, as successful Vietnamese Americans now, can help the country. And it's not really helping the communist government, it's helping the people.
Viet Q are investing in Vietnam in large numbers, partly due to the warming ties between Washington and Hanoi. The investments are on top of the $3 billion in remittances they send to relatives back home each year. Viet Q are also helping the third world country by transferring valuable skills and know-how. One example, a nanotechnology scientist, a Vietnamese-American from Silicon Valley, was recruited to run a research and development laboratory in southern Vietnam's prized high-tech industrial park. And Hanoi has sent several high-level delegations to Silicon Valley to woo Vietnamese-American tech entrepreneurs. But not everyone's buying in.
They're trying to lure the American public or American businessmen into do business with Vietnam. You want to go into business with somebody you trust, a trustworthy partner.
That's Dung Trân, a Silicon Valley engineer who protested the Vietnamese delegation. Like many at the rally, he's calling for a multi-party system and a government that respects human rights.
If a government that doesn't keep its word with its own citizen, how can it keep its word with its partners? And I believe that a democratic Vietnam will be a much better partner for everyone.
President Nguyen Minh Chit held his ground in talks with President Bush, who brought up Vietnam's human rights record and the recent jailing of dissidents. At the gathering with Vietnamese Americans, the topic was avoided altogether. Instead, he offered other welcome news. Starting in September, the country will no longer require entry visas for overseas Vietnamese. The visas had been a sticking point with those who left as refugees. In the past, the Vietnamese government had labeled them as traitors who deserted their homeland. President Nguyen also alluded to upcoming changes in citizenship and land rights for overseas Vietnamese. The announcements were further evidence that Vietnam now, more than ever, wants to reconcile with Vietnamese Americans, said American Ambassador Michael Marine.
There's a recognition of a need to expend more energy in building bridges to the Viet Q community in the United States. The American community also has to be ready to reach out. Many are, as we saw last night at the event where nearly 1,000 people from that community, many heard a very stirring speech from President Chet where he made it clear that they are important to Vietnam and to him personally. And I thought it was an excellent major step toward building the kind of relationship that is important, because I think the Vietnamese-American community has a lot to offer to Vietnam, to Vietnam's development.
But the past continues to divide the immigrant community. One Silicon Valley group of Vietnamese-American entrepreneurs recently held its inaugural dinner to promote trade between their adopted country and their homeland. Since then, the group's leaders have received death threats. 25 years ago, a young man attending his bachelor party got into an argument with two other men in a strip club in Detroit. The future groom was a Chinese-American engineer named Vincent Chin, and the two men who picked a fight with him were white auto workers. Later that night, the auto workers tracked Chin down in a parking lot and beat him to death with a baseball bat. They said they were upset about the loss of American jobs to Japanese competition. A judge seemed to sympathize with them, and the killers were given 3 years probation and fined $3,000. It might have been just another sad story of a crime that no one except the family would still remember decades later. But it wasn't. Chin's death was a wake-up call for Asian Americans. Americans of Chinese, Korean, and Japanese descent crossed ethnic lines for the first time and began to see themselves as part of a larger Asian American community. Journalist Helen Zia lived in Detroit at the time.
The Vincent Chin case was the landmark case that brought together all of our different communities. Before then, there were some smaller, college activist-oriented Pan-Asian organizations and efforts. But as far as a kind of mass movement of our different communities, where it really did affect the waiters, the cooks, the restaurant workers, as well as the PhD scientists and the college-educated people, across class, across multi-ethnic, multi-religious sort of effort, that began with the Vincent Chin case.
Helen Zia and other Asian American journalists and activists kept Vincent Chin's memory alive and his case before the public. A civil court eventually awarded Lily Chin, Vincent's mother, $1 million judgment, but she never received any of it. One of the men who murdered her son went underground to avoid paying. Lily Chin spent the next 20 years of her life campaigning for justice for her son and raising awareness of hate crimes.
I'm Yvonne Lee. I am a public policy consultant, and I'm also a member of the San Francisco Police Commission. At that time, I was working with a senior service agency, and Mrs. Chin, when she arrived in San Francisco, her passion and her call for justice inspired me and many of my colleagues to get involved with the civil rights and social justice movement for Asian Pacific Americans, and that's how I started my career in civil rights. So when a grieving mother galvanized her grief and her pain to really talk to us and send a message, I think it really touched all of us that if she can stand up, we must also join her. And it's very unfortunate that she was the unwitting leader for our community because of her son's death. But she has touched so many people's lives. She has created a movement that is continuing to be strong.
Yvonne Lee and Helen Zia, remembering the legacy of the murder of Vincent Chin. He died in a Detroit hospital on June 23, 1982. He was 27. Put on your walking shoes. We take a stroll through Manila coming up. You're listening to Pacific Time on PRI, Public Radio International. Manila, the capital of the Philippines, was once known as the Pearl of the Orient. It was a cosmopolitan city of splendor and comfort. But these days, many visitors come away with a completely different view. Concrete malls, slums, and choking traffic jams. It's become known as Metro Manila, the city itself plus 16 surrounding suburbs. Even its 12 million residents are often hard-pressed to find something nice to say about their sprawling metropolis. But as Simon Montlake finds out, if this old pearl of a city seems lost, it can be rediscovered. It just takes a bit of imagination and a crafty tour guide.
Today's tour, just like everything else in the Philippines, just like television, like movies, like school, today's tour will also begin with...
Hello, I'm Carlos Saldron, and I am an architectural and historical walking tour guide of the city of Manila. I do a historical street theater. I think Manila is one of the most underrated cities in the world when it comes to interest. Actually, beneath all of the visual cacophony that you see lies a really interesting city full of history. It's kind of like the Middle Kingdom. It's kind of like Lord of the Rings, a lost kingdom that one has to rediscover.
5 years ago, Carlos Saldron set out to prove that a tour guide means much more than just pointing out the sights. He began using music and photographs, costumes and maps, and his own vivid imagination. And so the walking tour of Manila was born. Conquered in the 16th century by Spain, then colonized for 50 years by the United States, Manila has a rich and colorful past. Unfortunately, much of that glorious history was turned to rubble by World War II.
So sometimes you're showing us things that aren't actually there anymore.
Yeah, I have to, because most of Manila was completely destroyed in World War II. Which makes it a rather surreal experience, because when I talk to you about this and that, the only evidence that I have that this and that existed is through a photograph.
By the end of the war, only one of its colonial churches was still standing. I joined Carlos on his popular tour of Intramuros, the walled Spanish city that was once the spiritual heart of Manila. Dressed in Spanish costume and carrying a book of photos and other props, Carlos led us on a dizzying dance through the past. Other tours are more whimsical. They include the public works of Imelda Marcos, the former First Lady who is best known for her shoe collection. What they all have in common is a sense of comic irreverence. Here's his explanation of the Spanish galleon trade in Chinese goods to Europe.
That is the way that most Europeans at that time were able to get their silk, their spices, their Chinese goods, especially things like blue and white china. And blue and white china or porcelana was the cash cow of the Spanish during the Manila-Acapulco galleon trade, which ran for around 200 years, simply because Europeans at that time did not know how to make porcelain. And the markup of the Spanish was insane. Because in China, blue and whites were considered to be next to useless. It was a common good, right? The elite of China would never dream about using blue and white china. Oh my God, it's so gauche. Give it to the maid now, please, take it, right? But the second this entered Europe, it became a Gucci bag, okay? So in one country, it's plastic, and in the next country, it becomes Prada. And the Spanish kept the change.
Foreign visitors aren't the only ones that need help to find the hidden beauty of Manila. Carlos says local residents are surprised to find out that so much history lies beneath their feet, even if so many of the buildings have been lost to the past.
I hope that by teaching people, especially local Filipinos, about our history and how it's connected to international history, it'll give them a better understanding of where they came from and their own identity and where we came from and where we're going. And for foreigners, it gives a foreigner and an insight into why things are the way they are around here. Because Manila really needs an instruction booklet.
For Pacific Time, this is Simon Montlake in Manila.
The Philippines was under American control during World War II, and President Franklin Roosevelt called on Filipinos then to fight for America and join the United States Armed Forces in the Far East. But after the war, Congress passed an act that stripped them of their status as American veterans, along with the benefits that came with it. And for the past 16 years, the Filipino-American community has been trying to get a bill passed that would finally recognize the Filipino fighters as American vets. Now, an American major general has stepped in to fight for the proposal, known as the Filipino Veterans Equity Act. But this isn't just any major general. It's Antonio Taguba, one of the highest-ranking Filipino-Americans to serve in the U.S. military. He was asked to retire this year after authoring a critical report on the torture of Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison. Odette Keeley of New American Media recently met with Major General Taguba. She told us how his involvement in pushing for the act might make a difference.
General Taguba, Major General Antonio Taguba, remains a hero in the eyes of Filipinos all over, not only in the U.S., in the Philippines, and in the world for what he has done and what he stood for, which was service to country and service to the truth. His integrity, his honesty is well acclaimed. And in the way that I met him on Sunday for the first time, he's a slight, very nondescriptly dressed, very humble person. You can sense that he has that core strength and brain as sharp as a steel trap. And there were statements that were said during this particular meeting when he met with a group of select Filipino and Asian media, with a group of Filipino veterans and some local officials. Rudy Asercion, who is the American Legion War Memorial Commissioner in the city of San Francisco, said, I want to make a public statement, want to make a press statement. I am ashamed. I am angry that my country, the United States, has treated General Taguba in the same way he's treating the veterans, that they're spoils of war, they're mistreated, and especially in the case of General Taguba, echoed by another Filipino leader and media man, Greg Macabenta, that this person, General Taguba, doing his duty, was persecuted for it. He was punished. If he was, as many people now believe, forced to retire, forced to resign from his post, and criticized by senior military officials, he did it out of duty. He did what he was asked to do, and yet he suffered for it.
Now, he's now a vocal proponent of the Filipino Veterans Equity Bill. Has he always been spoken out in support of the bill, or is this a new development for the Filipino-American veterans?
He gave us the impression that certainly behind, in the sidelines, behind the scenes, he was closely monitoring what was going on. And certainly, now a retired general, he himself is a veteran. His father is a veteran who is receiving benefits. This issue is very close to his heart. He is as passionate about it as he was passionate and always will be passionate about serving the country and doing his duty. And he feels that with the influence, the stature that he has gained, that his name can open doors. He has colleagues in this U.S. Senate Veterans Affairs Committees and in the military establishment and in the halls of Congress that he can tap into and certainly push for bringing justice to the veterans. It's been 6 decades now.
And has his involvement seemed to be making a difference? The bill, I guess, went through a markup hearing this week.
Right. On Wednesday at about 9:30 a.m. Eastern, among five legislations, Senate Bill 57, which is the Filipino Veterans Equity Act or pending bill, was part of a markup hearing in the U.S. Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. And out of that meeting, the outcome was that this Senate Bill 57 or the Filipino Veterans Equity Act got incorporated into another bill.
I guess even within the Filipino American community, there's still a lot of debate about the bill itself. And I mean, it's been around for 16 years. What is this debate over and how come it's never gotten onto the Senate floor?
In the 16 years and with different factions, inevitably you have Filipino groups and advocates working out of Washington, D.C., out of California, out of Hawaii, out of New York, New Jersey. There have been different stances, different positions. In the beginning of that 16-year struggle, there was certainly a lot of heated debate and animosity that you have a group that's saying, this is an all-or-nothing battle. If we are not given the same amount of pension or full benefits that all American veterans for the same kind of service given, I understand it's about $911 a month that American war veterans for World War II are being given. If we're not given that, it's all or nothing. We're not going to take anything less for our Filipino veterans. But yet there is another group that's saying, wait a minute, if we can get some money that will help these aging veterans, they're dying every day. They're less than 19,000 now. Something that can also give to their widows and families. Another group is saying if we can get even $200 minimum a month for both the veterans here and the veterans in the Philippines equal, that's something that they're pushing for. And it's cooled down. The debate has cooled down. And maybe that is what exactly General Taguba was pointing out in this private meeting on Sunday, was that if legislators are looking at the community with so many different fronts, so many different positions, it's never going to work. It has to go back to the vision that this is justice for veterans. A lot has been lost in the shuffle, and he feels, let's go back to our original intent, and that is to give justice and due recognition to our Filipino veterans.
Odette Keeley is chief of staff at New America Media, a consortium of ethnic press. And some final notes on what else is happening around Asia and Asian America.
Inspectors from the United Nations visited a North Korean nuclear reactor this week. It was the first time an international monitoring team was allowed into the Yongbyon plant since 2002. North Korea agreed in February to shut down the reactor but has missed key deadlines. Analysts were optimistic the visit means North Korea plans to stand by the agreement. But Pyongyang also tested a ballistic missile this week. That drew concerned reactions from Japan and the United States. You've heard of Condi rice. But did you know that Sticky Rice is running for president? You heard right. The Federal Justice Department is pressuring Boston election officials to translate candidates' names into Chinese characters. They want to make sure voters who don't speak English can understand the ballots. In many cases, names like Mitt Romney, a.k.a. Sticky Rice, are translated into Chinese characters that closely match the sound of each syllable. Also lost in this translation is Barack Obama, who could be known to Chinese-speaking voters as O Bus Horse. It's time for us to run. Our theme music was composed by Anthony Brown with the Asian American Orchestra. Visit us on the web at kqed.org/pacific time. Got a story idea or a comment on something you've heard here? Email us, pacifictime@kqed.org. Our staff includes Nina Thorson, Nguyen Quy Duc, Danny Bringer, Sarah Bon, Susie Rocho, Helen Lee, Michelle Cheng, Larissa Zhou, Hannah Goldfield, and Raul Ramirez. And I'm Juan Ha. Thanks for tuning in.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.